I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In recent months, the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services and its commissioner, Nick Tumpas, have been in the thick of a crisis that's made national headlines. A former employee of Exeter Hospital allegedly infected more than 30 patients with hepatitis C after stealing drugs and contaminating syringes. That employee was reportedly fired from several hospitals elsewhere in the country before coming to New Hampshire, prompting questions about how someone with such red flags in his work history could end up hopping from state to state, and whether there's enough being done to ensure patients are protected. There were questions, too, about the state's response to the outbreak, with complaints New Hampshire moved too slowly to get its testing plans in place, but Commissioner Tumpas said New Hampshire needed adequate time to ensure proper staffing and supplies, given the scope of the potential testing. The state recently completed that testing for more than 1,000 patients at several public health clinics. Nick Tumpas has seen his share of crises over his tenure as head of the state's largest agency. He's had to make huge budget cuts and lay off hundreds of staff, even as more and more people needed services because of the troubled economy. His agency has faced lawsuits, one over access to health care for Medicaid patients and another over inadequate mental health services. Meanwhile, Tumpas is in the midst of negotiating with federal officials over plans to shift the Medicaid program to a managed care system, while the recent Supreme Court ruling over the Federal Affordable Care Act has introduced uncertainty over the future of Medicaid. Today in The Exchange, we sit down with Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Tumpas, and we'd like to hear from you. Have you or has anyone you know been affected by budget cuts to the agency? What would you like to see the department doing about the health issues New Hampshire is facing? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. Commissioner Tumpas, always nice to have you on The Exchange. Welcome back. Let's start with the hepatitis C outbreak.
Sure.
The state was holding testing clinics last week for another group of Exeter Hospital patients. So where do we stand now?
We have completed testing right now for we've done about 2,500 tests between those that the department has done through the several clinics that we ran in various locations across the state, as well as what Exeter Hospital did in their facilities. And also we had two satellite blood drawing locations that were provided by Portsmouth Regional Hospital as well. So all in all, overall, I believe there were over 2,500 people that were tested. As of very recently, we had confirmed that over 2,400 of those were negative. And there are 51 that we are still processing in terms of looking at the test, and everything runs through our public health lab. What we're really looking at is to see if any of the positives that we do identify, and we certainly expected to find a number of positive positives for the testing. But whether or not those are related to the initial outbreak that occurred in the cardiac catheterization unit of the hospital is really the key point that we're looking for right now.
So there may be other cases of hepatitis C, but now the question is whether they match the strains or seem to be related to the cases that are already confirmed.
Well, for example, when we did the original testing for those that were in the cardiac catheterization unit, we found, as you indicated earlier, there were 33 positives, 32 for the patients, one for the individual employee, and then there were an additional 17 that we found that were positive within that group that we had tested, but they're not related to the outbreak. So there was no cluster or anything there, which just underscores the point: when you do the testing on hepatitis C, you're going to find anywhere from 1.5 to 2% of the population that will have it, but they may not know that.
Now, the state has also been looking to test a number of employees in Exeter Hospital because of the most recent case that was confirmed where the individual who was admitted before the suspect began working at Exeter Hospital. And so the state wanted to rule out whether there was potentially a second source of hepatitis C. And Exeter Hospital pushed back about that at first. There's voluntary testing now, but there was some dispute.
Right. And so our team, led by Dr. Jose Montero, Dr. Sharon Oilright Price, our state epidemiologist, have been working very closely with Exeter Hospital in terms of working through all the mechanics and so forth. A number of issues on that. That's really part of the investigation. I'll let them do that investigation. This has got enough visibility as it is. I'd rather let them work it from a science basis in order to be able to deal with that. But we've made the point very clearly to the public and to Exeter Hospital that we believe very strongly that these people need to be tested in order to be able to, as you say, rule out that there is something else that is going on there.
But in a case like this, the state can't simply go to the hospital and say, this testing must be done. They have to talk or negotiate.
We're working through that, but there are a number of steps that we could take beyond this. But clearly, we would like to be able to work very closely with the hospital on that.
Can you tell us about the state's work with the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services? There was the report that after state officials helped inspect Exeter Hospital, and the report said the hospital had a number of clinical and life safety violations, including the failure to secure some of these controlled medications.
And basically, that report that was done, there were several reports that will probably come out of this whole process. That being one that was done through our health facilities licensing group that went over there and did a review of the procedures and so forth, and they did find a number of issues there. I don't have the specifics of those, Brady, but those were well documented, and they were provided to Exeter Hospital. I'm confident Exeter Hospital has been working in terms of being able to address those. I also think it's a wake-up call for a number of other hospitals in terms of anything that we come out there. Again, this is a in many respects, Exeter Hospital was also victimized on this as well as the people who were victimized by the individual there. So, in many respects, what we want to try to do right now is to make sure that we get the process, the procedures, things down that they should be doing. Everybody should be looking at so that this type of thing doesn't happen again. Dr. Montero has said it repeatedly from the outset of this. This never should have happened.
And with you called it a wake-up call. Is this something that you expect your department to have to come back to Exeter or any of the other hospitals and keep an eye on these procedures, make sure that there is no concern going forward?
Well, that's an ongoing responsibility that the department has through a group outside of public health. But one of the things that we are doing is that there will be several reports that will come out of this. One that you mentioned through the CMS as well as our health facilities group. There will be other that will be an after action report that will be done 90 days after we close the investigation. That's our responsibility to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. We also have the epidemiological investigation, and the report that we will provide back to Exeter Hospital as well as to other ones. That's a very complex type of report that's going to get into a lot of detail there. So there are several things, but ultimately what we want to be able to do is be able to get to the bottom of it. What happened? Why did it happen? What do we need to do in order to be able to prevent that from happening again in any institution here in New Hampshire? And because, as you've mentioned, the individual had worked in eight other states, we want what we found here. And I will tell you that this is a national story, but were it not for the professionalism, the leadership and so forth of our public health division here as part of the department, they were the ones that identified this, found what the source of it is, and has been driving the investigation. that has led to a lot of this being publicized across the country right now.
But that does seem to make this investigation more complicated, the fact that this is an individual who had worked in a number of states before coming to New Hampshire, and it's come out now that there were some – he'd been fired from a number of institutions, including one instance where he was allegedly found with drugs in his system, and that seemed to have slipped through the cracks. And
As I called it, when we were over at the clinic in Stratham, I talked with some people, and I called it – it was just a massive systemic breakdown. That type of thing is again, as we look at this, when in the midst of this tragedy, now what we need to do is step back and take a look at what are the policy type of things that we need to do. I know that the New Hampshire legislature is already looking at a number of policy initiatives that need to be done here. We've been working with them at some level, but clearly when the legislature does reconvene in January, they will be looking at this. Some of these things are things that we need to do, we can look at here in the state. There are other things. For example, one of the areas that is being discussed, as you just referenced, is some type of a registry for healthcare professionals. That's really more of a national issue. Obviously, there's a number of implications on that. But all I'm asking is that as the legislature looks at this, is that they really take a thoughtful examination. Again, in the heat of all this, I think it's important to kind of step back and say, let's look at this in a systemic way. And do the right thing in order to be able to deal with quality going forward here.
And one of the issues that's come up as lawmakers have been considering the aftermath of the outbreak at Exeter Hospital was the idea of mandatory drug testing. Do you see that as a net positive, perhaps?
Well, again, there are several policy thrusts that I believe that are happening. That is one, Brady, around the mandatory testing for healthcare employees. There are other ones that the registry that I mentioned. There's also a discussion about making hepatitis C a reportable disease. There are also other things that are looking at reporting potential drug use on the part of people and so forth. So there's a range of different things that need to be looked at here. But again, I just think it ought to be a thoughtful dialogue to make sure that the policymakers, as they look at this, they work with the department, they bring other experts in so that we take the circumstances and the tragedy here and turn it into a net positive that will help improve overall quality of healthcare.
Today on The Exchange, we're talking with Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Tompas. We've been talking about the hepatitis C issue, and coming up after a short break, we'll continue to talk about hepatitis C as well as the state budget and its effect on the Department of Health and Human Services. And we'd like to take your questions as well. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. You can keep in touch with NHPR wherever you go. Of course, we're on Facebook and Twitter, but you can also share photos with us on Flickr or take a look at some of our YouTube videos. NHPR, we're not your parents' public radio station. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Ansel & Anderson, Trust and Estate Attorneys. Pleased to be celebrating 10 years of underwriting on NHPR. On the web at Ansel & Anderson in Bedford. And from Heritage Plumbing, Heating & Cooling, offering tune-ups, repairs, and efficient air conditioning systems, including ductless AC for homes without ductwork. Online at justcallheritage.com. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Canoy. Today on The Exchange, we're talking with Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Tompas about how, after repeated budget cuts, his department is adjusting. We'd like you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. You can also send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. We've been talking about the Hepatitis C investigation, Commissioner, and I wanted to ask you one more question about that, because right before the break we were talking about how lawmakers have responded and the ideas that they've been considering going forward. And one issue that's come up with a number of lawmakers, including Peter Bragdon, the president of the state Senate, has said they wanted to make sure the state isn't at the end on the hook for the costs of the additional testing. And so the question to me is, are you going to seek reimbursement from Exeter Hospital when this investigation is all said and done?
Well, first off, related to the cost, one of the things that I've consistently told our public health division and the people who are doing the investigation and so forth is that I do not want anybody coming back and saying, we can't do the right thing for the health and safety of the population and getting to the bottom of this and pointing to the fact that we don't have budget in order to be able to do this. Basically, do the right thing, identify what the costs are, let's track what those costs are. Right now, they're pushing somewhere around $350,000 when you start adding for the supplies, for the overtime and so forth. The response that we did in terms of the clinics and so forth was just a marvelous effort on the part of many different organizations, including state agencies, other members of the Department of Health and Human Services, the public health networks that we've spawned over the last number of years to help us respond to these type of things. So the whole point right now has been to be able to track that and so forth. We've begun discussions with Exeter Hospital, as well as others, in order to be able to deal with this. Again, that's something that it's on the table. I know it's there. Clearly, that's going to be a discussion that we're going to have, but I'll just leave it at that right now.
There's so much more we could talk about just on hepatitis C alone, but so much more that is in your portfolio right now, and I wanted to ask about one of the biggest issues, which is the move of Medicaid to a managed care model. And could you first, just for those who don't know, explain a little bit about how the state manages Medicaid now and how this move will change?
Medicaid is a $1.4 billion program here in the state of New Hampshire. It is, by itself, almost 26% of the entire state budget. Today, Medicaid, when it makes payments on behalf of individuals who receive services, everything is done in what we call a fee-for-service. You have a particular service, we pay that. Everything is really a transactional type of a thing. Whatever the service, test, drug, and so forth is, that's what we pay that, again, for the eligible and approved type of services. Under a managed care model, what we are doing now is working with three other entities. In our case, we've chosen to work with three other entities, managed care organizations. And we shift the model in order to say, rather than paying everything on a transactional basis, we to the managed care organizations, we will pay them a fixed amount per month for each member that they have within their respective plan. And it's based up by eligibility category. It's not based on the service. It's based on the eligibility category. The intent there with care management, and I deliberately call it care management, managed care management, but care management really gets at what we're really trying to do on this, which is really to improve the health, the outcomes, access to services, and in particular primary care. Because that's really the cornerstone of what we wanted to be able to do, is to make sure that every one of the Medicaid beneficiaries has a primary care physician or a medical home in order to be able to get the advice and the counsel in terms of navigating the system to be able to do the preventative type of measures, as opposed to just waiting until somebody gets terribly sick, and they're very expensive when that happens.
So under the fee-for-service model, the issue is that people don't necessarily seek care early enough, and that with the care management, as you call it, people may seek the care earlier.
Well, under the current model that we have, there's no requirement that any one of the Medicaid beneficiaries has a primary care physician. That's one of the first things that we will deal with the care management program, is that everybody will be required to have a primary care physician, because right now, without a primary care physician, many of the people will seek primary care services, but in venues that are much more expensive than if they just went to their primary care physician, specifically to the emergency department of the of a hospital. So the intent of care management, again, is to better manage the care for those that are really complex type of cases that involve multiple conditions that the person is dealing with. Again, as opposed to looking at it on a transactional basis, looking at it from a standpoint in a more the whole person and looking at the whole person and looking at their overall health and the outcomes that we want to try to achieve for that individual. It is a dramatically different model to use. But New Hampshire is, we're I believe, the 48th state that is embracing managed care for the Medicaid population. So it's not like we're blazing a new trail here. We can learn from a lot of the things that have happened in other states where things didn't go so well. So we can learn from that and apply those lessons to putting together our plan here, which we believe is a very thoughtful plan that will play out over the next several years.
And that was going to be the next question that I had, because with those other states come some concerns that critics have brought up. And there was a study recently by Bloomberg Government that said that a number of the Medicaid managed care plans, especially those run by for-profit insurers, report below average access to medical services. And New York State, the critics bring up as an example, saying essentially in the effort to keep costs down, quality of care went down. So what kind of oversight can your department provide to make sure that something like that doesn't happen here, especially given the constant concerns about the budget?
We have very specific measures, metrics within the contract that we will hold the managed care organizations accountable for regarding access to services, regarding quality. The legislation, Senate Bill 147, that was passed and signed into law by Governor Lynch, that law very specifically said we would move into the managed care environment, but quality would not be one of the things that would suffer as a result of that. So we have a number of controls around the individual, around the provider, and so forth, in order to be able to assure that we will have a high level of quality and that we're not going to have somebody's services being cut, if you will, in order to be able to make a particular number that we've got. So that's something that we will be monitoring and overseeing that on a consistent basis.
And part of that eventually, not right away, but eventually will include some of the long-term supports that the department provides. And we got an email from Kathy. She writes, and it's been called step two of this move. She writes, what will it take for the department to accept that moving long-term habilitative supports for people with developmental disabilities to inexperienced for-profit managed care organizations is foolish, since agencies providing these services now will lose their state contracts at the implementation of step two? The move will likely destroy the locally controlled nonprofit area agency system families have built over 30 years, and the state will shed many hundreds of jobs. That's an email we got from Kathy. What do you make of that, Commissioner?
I could spend the next hour talking about that one area first, and I respect what Kathy is saying. I respect that there's a number of people that have different view. The fact of the matter is we said we were going to do the long-term care services and supports for both the elderly as well as for those with physical and developmental disabilities. We put that into a step two. We wanted to make sure that we got the foundation in place, and then we would work that. That's number one. Number two is we have a group that is being led by the department to define what the step two model, step two services, and how that is all going to play out. That is not something that I'm handing off to the managed care organization and say, here, have at it. These are our beneficiaries. These are our citizens that my department is still responsible for those. We have an outreach plan that we're putting together right now in order to be able to engage the clients, the families, the caregivers, the providers into a discussion and a dialogue regarding the principles, the values, and the type of things. There's a number of things that we've got in terms of our system that we clearly want to be able to preserve. But there's a number of things when we start looking at the cost associated with that those populations. Again, Medicaid, as I indicated earlier, Brady, Medicaid is a $1.4 billion program. If you look at the skew in terms of the populations, roughly 80% of that population that we serve is a low-income women and children, but they consume about 20-25% of the entire spend. The other 25% of the population, thereabouts, consumes close to 70% of the spend. I know that those numbers don't exactly add up, but those are – but that it's that rough order of magnitude. Look at it as an 80-20, and it's those areas. And when you start looking at the demographics in terms of the aging of the population and so forth, that's the area that we need to be thoughtful about how we're going about doing it. We deliberately said we were going to defer that into a second step because we recognize that we are breaking some new ground here. But we're also working with a set of agencies and a set of things that are in place here in the state of New Hampshire that we can build upon. I have no intention, and I've been very upfront with this with the various communities. I've stood in front of people and said, it is not my intention to tear the thing down and then build something else in its place. There are a number of things that we can, again, build on. It doesn't mean that I maintain the status quo with everything that there is there today, but the values and the things that we want to be able to do in terms of moving it forward is something that we will be listening, having those people, a variety of different people that we're already starting to do the outreach on that right now to get them so that they are part of the process and help us to define it. It is not something that I'm just handing it off to a set of organizations that don't know New Hampshire as well as the people in New Hampshire know New Hampshire.
Kathy, thanks so much for that email. And we invite you to join us with your questions and comments as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Well, Commissioner, where is HHS in this process of transition? When do you expect to start enrolling people in step one, I guess?
There are several precedent events that need to happen before we can move forward. First and foremost is the approvals on the part of the federal government. When the contracts were passed by the governor and executive council back in May, we sent a state plan amendment, which gives us the authority in order to be able to do a managed care program here in the state. We also submitted our contract that we're going to be using for the managed care organizations, as well as the rates, in order for the federal government to certify that the rates are actuarially sound. In other words, there's some thought that goes into what those rates are. Now, we have been working diligently with the federal government. We had not and do not have the full approvals on those right now, but I'm very optimistic that we are moving forward with the federal government in order to be able to secure all the federal approvals that we will need in order to allow us to be able to move forward. That's but one key issue. There's a range of different things. Again, we could spend a considerable amount of time talking about this, but the nothing happens in terms of moving forward, first off, without those approvals on the part of the federal government. And then secondly, is that the managed care organizations need to demonstrate to the department that they have adequate networks, meaning that the Medicaid beneficiaries are going to have the appropriate venues in order to be able to go in order to be able to receive the services. Hospitals, mental health centers, community health centers, specialty practices around various medical issues, as well as primary care practices. All that has to be put into place by each one of the managed care organizations and demonstrate that they have statewide access available to any one of the members that would come within their particular plan. So we've got a lot of work to do, and again, there's a number of other components that we are working on, but the two key things that we're doing, one is to get the federal government approvals, and number two is to have the managed care organizations demonstrate to the department that they have adequate networks, and that's defined, very well defined within the contract around distance, around the access to services, quality, and so forth.
So progress being made, but not quite to a timeline yet.
Significant progress that's being made. At this point, We still have a targeted go-live date of January 1st. That could well change, again, based on the variables that I'm talking about. It is an extraordinarily complex and involved undertaking on the part of the department. My department staff have done a remarkable job in terms of gearing up and doing this on top of a number of other things that they're already doing right now.
Now, this whole conversation about the transition in Medicaid is happening against the backdrop where the Supreme Court has ruled on the Federal Affordable Care Act, and there's now Medicaid expansion is optional. States are not required under that act to expand Medicaid. And a number of lawmakers in this state and in others have said that states should not expand Medicaid. Where do you think New Hampshire should go?
Well, first off, it's a decision that's a decision that on the part of the policymakers. It is not the department's decision. What I view as my responsibility as the leader of the Department of Health and Human Services is to provide unbiased data back to the policymakers to say these are the variables that you need to consider, because we clearly have an issue with the uninsured nationwide as well as here in New Hampshire. And so what we are doing right now is we are preparing to have some analysis done to take a look at how many people are we talking about that would be part of the Medicaid expansion, when would we likely see them coming into the program, how much would those people cost, what type of infrastructure do we need in order to be able to support them, what are the implications going to be on the state budget, what are the implications going to be on the commercial insurance marketplace, what are the implications going to be on the state budget, and so on. So there's we're putting together a scope of work in order to be able to secure an entity to come in and be able to provide that analysis. And we've reached out to policymakers on both sides of the political aisle, as well as others various stakeholders and advocates and so forth, to say, if you were going to do this, what type of questions would you want to have answered? So we've gone through and asked them those type of questions. We've sat down with the speaker. We've sat down with members of the Senate, including Senator Bradley, who was here on the program back several weeks ago and specifically said that we should be looking at doing this type of analysis. So it is our intent to be able to have that done and have that ready by the middle part of October is what our timeline is, so that would be there in time for the general election, for the policymakers to basically have this type of data. And that's what I want them to do, is to basically say, understand what the opportunities are, what the costs are, what the benefits are, because it's not a simple matter.
We're talking with Commissioner Nick Tumpas of the Department of Health and Human Services today on The Exchange. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll ask the commissioner about the state budget and its effect on health and human services. We'd also like to take your questions. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Back after a short break. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our members, and from Ollie at Granite State College, learning for the fun of it for ages 50 plus in Claremont, Concord, Conway, Manchester, and the Seacoast. Fall class catalog at olli.granite.edu. And from thelobbynh.com, the new online source for New Hampshire business and politics, found at thelobbynh.com. This is NHPR.
Today on Word of Mouth, face-to-face in the digital age. A marketer of the moment highlights the persuasive power of actual conversations in the era of social networking. Plus, an interview we couldn't pass up. The Reverend Al Green joins us to talk about love and music and the evolution of soul. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay together with Word of Mouth today at noon on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, We'll have Laura Kanoy back in talking about civics in New Hampshire schools. That conversation tomorrow. So email us your questions, exchange@nhpr.org, and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, we're talking with Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Tumpas. His agency has seen steep budget cuts in recent years and is now battling state hospitals and the U.S. Department of Justice over issues of taxation and patient care. We're hearing his takes on these issues, as well as how the state is handling new aspects of the federal health care law and bills before the legislature concerning health and human services. We'd love to hear from you as well. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And Commissioner Tumpas, I wanted to also ask you briefly about West Nile virus, because we've been hearing about that in recent weeks. The state saw its first case in several years. And nationally, this has been a huge issue, a potentially record number of cases and a large number of deadly cases included in those. What are we seeing in this state?
Basically, nationally, as of last week, there were roughly 1,200 reported West Nile virus cases across the country through 38 states. 41 deaths have been reported on that. We have one human case here in the state of New Hampshire. We recently requested, and the governor agreed to. Call for a public health threat, if you will, to various communities, primarily in the southeastern corridor of the state, that basically allows the communities, in order to be able to take the type of measures, spraying and so forth, that would basically help mitigate the issue. But the bottom line in all this, again, it is something that. Is troubling to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention across the in the country as they're looking at this, saying this is unlike anything they've seen. We don't know exactly why that is, but the bottom line for people here is that you can take precautions in terms of your own yards to make sure that there are no standing pools of water, to wear protective clothing, to use the DEET or some derivative of that when you're out. Out and about in the yards, especially for children.
I also wanted to ask you about the state of the prescription drug monitoring law, which was signed into effect. And this is something that's been in place in a number of other states, but is relatively new to New Hampshire. Where are we at on that?
That's something I don't have a whole lot of insight in at this particular point, other than the fact that is starting. I'm just really not in a position right now to be able to address that one, Brady.
And some news yesterday that from House Speaker William O'Brien saying that your department was going to start implementing the law about welfare recipients and doing background checks to stop fraud. What can you tell us about where we stand on that?
Well, again, where we are is we released a request for proposal that was in line with the legislation that was passed by the legislature. And it's early on in the process. The issues that I had is in terms of where that goes in terms of the placement of that particular additional checks, depending upon where you put that into the end of the process for determining of eligibility, could be a substantial amount of dollars that would be associated with that for the state. But again, we've crafted a request for proposal, just released that. The speaker, literally, I got the letter late yesterday from the speaker expressing a couple of questions that he had on that, and I will certainly make sure that we follow up with the speaker on that.
You mentioned the prospect of spending additional dollars, and that ties into the broad issue that comes up every time we have you on the exchange, which is that idea of the budget trying to do more with less. There are new requests that come in, new things that seem to need to be done, and only so many resources. First of all, I'm curious, where are caseloads right now? Have they been rising in recent years, or are they starting to fall as the economy starts that slow recovery?
If sometimes when I'm talking about the budget, I want to look at my watch and say, is it February 2nd? Because it's sort of Groundhog's Day, just the same thing over and over again. But over the past 3 years, from July of 2009 until July of this year, our caseloads have gone up fairly dramatically. And again, there was a period there that they grew quite dramatically. But for that period from July of 2009 until July of this year, our unduplicated count of individuals for our major programs, Medicaid, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program or food stamps, long-term care services and a couple of other programs, the major programs, our unduplicated count is now somewhere close to 157,000 people. That's up 11.5% over that three-year period. The Medicaid caseload is right now at about 129,000 people. That's up somewhat because we incorporated the Children's Health Insurance Program into the those folks came into the Medicaid program as an expansion there, but that caseload is up 14% over the past 3 years, and then the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program or the food stamp program, that's the big one, and again that's a 100% federal benefit, but our caseloads over that 3 year period have grown 35%,
wow.
An additional almost 31,000. Individuals now are eligible for that food stamp program, and that really, for us to borrow an analogy from the mining industry, that's the canary in the cave. That basically tells us when we see that rising, we know that some of the other programs are going to see things rising further. I'm concerned about that right now because when you start looking at the drought that's been happening in the Midwest and that we expect food prices to go up, it's going to put greater pressure on many families across the state. So those caseloads have continued to go up. They've moderated somewhat. They have not gone down. The growth is moderated, but again, they do not go down, despite the fact that our unemployment rate is one of the is the envy of the nation. But it's still, you know, five or so percent, I believe, is where we are. At the same time, over that three-year period that our caseloads have gone up, our human resources that we've had in order to deal with the increased caseloads have gone down by 13%.
I was going to say, caseloads go up. That doesn't necessarily mean resources for your department
go up as well. It has been, and especially in these areas, because These are the people who work in the frontline institutions. These are the people who work in our field organizations. Yes, the administrators within the department. A key group that is involved in this are the frontline eligibility workers that determine the eligibility for every one of these programs, food stamps, Medicaid, and so forth. That eligibility needs to be checked every 6 months, and so consequently. When you look at this caseload, you can double that in terms of the amount of activity that those caseworkers need to deal with, and that only deals with the ones that are accepted. I'm not talking about the number that were applied and were not accepted because they didn't meet the eligibility criteria. So, it is a very challenging environment for our staff. They do a remarkable job. In the face of this, I mean, day after day when people are coming in and they've lost their job, or especially up in the North Country where some of the mills and other type of things where there's a much different environment, much different set of challenges than we face down here in the southern part of the state.
You mentioned February of next year, and that's when we might start to see some of the proposals that the next governor will start to put forward for the budget. Does there come a point where you would advise the governor or lawmakers, other officials, to say we're doing as much as we possibly can without further resources? We literally cannot do more.
Our approach right now, we have a for our budget for state fiscal year 13, which is roughly $2 billion. That's a lot of money, to be sure. Roughly $650 million of that is from the general fund. So it is incumbent upon our department in order to be able to manage those resources in the most effective and efficient way as we possibly can. We are looking at, for state fiscal year 13, that began in July, we're projecting right now a shortfall of around $25 million in general funds that we project that we're going to have at the end of the fiscal year. I can't wait until the end of the fiscal year in order to say, what am I going to do on that? So we're already in the process of having discussions with the governor. In July, we met with a number of the announced candidates for governor, invited them in to be able to meet with my management team within the department. We provided a little bit of an overview of the department and shared with them what some of the operational strategic challenges that we have, as well as some of the opportunities that we have, so that they get a better understanding of what they'll be dealing with when they come in. Because, again, we're a significant part of the state budget. So right now, we're in the process of developing the agency budget, which is required by law that we need to file that in the October timeline. And when we sit down with the governor, the new governor, and when we sit down with the legislature, what we will be doing is laying out the choices for people to say, here is what we're doing right now. The maintenance budget says this is what we need in order to be able to do the job according to the laws that are in place. The fact that I have fewer resources in order to be able to deal with it, I need to make sure that the department goes to the legislature and make them understand, if we get substantially less in this particular area, here's what the implications are going to be. Here are the number of people that aren't going to be served. Here are the possible implications from a litigation standpoint or some other type of a way, whether it is from agencies that will no longer be able to survive and so forth. So there's a number of different issues there. It is something that we need to go back with, and we've done this over the past couple of budgets, and it's been applauded by the policymakers, because we come in, it's uncomfortable sometimes for people to listen to that, because we're giving them the facts, giving them the data, in order for them to be able to make their decisions, because they're the policymakers, they're the ones that set where the priorities are going to be. So we will argue that these are the resources that we need, and when we get less than what we believe that we need, we're going to basically say, here's what the implications of that are going to be. So at some point here, it will become clear who our next governor is going to be, and then I'll work with he or she in order to be able to craft a budget that they'll introduce in February of next year.
And looking much further down the road, New Hampshire is graying. Our demographics are skewing older. Will the cuts that have been made and may be made in the near future possibly affect how well New Hampshire deals with 15, 20, 30 years from now, as the costs of servicing that population inevitably start to rise?
Well, again, a big part of what there are in the midst of some of the challenges that we deal with, there are also some opportunities, and there are some things that are happening at the federal level, whether they're related to the Affordable Care Act or whether there are other type of initiatives that are there. But one of the things that we're trying to do is, especially in the area of long-term care, specifically around seniors, is to shift the balance that we have in terms of the people that we serve in an institutional setting versus those that we can serve in a home and community-based care environment. The people want those choices in order to be able to stay within their community for as long as they possibly can. And by providing those particular supports and services, we're able to maintain and allow them to be able to stay within the community. Unfortunately, what happens in terms of some of the budget choices that have to be made, some of those services are cut. And what that does is it triggers the phenomenon. Now somebody's going to end up in a much higher level of cost service. Those are the type of things, again, that we need to make very clear to the policymakers, to the public and others, that's coming. But again, especially in that area of the long-term care, again, given the demographic that you're looking at, there have been some studies that show, you know, the percentage of the population that will be older, you know, above 65 and so forth is pretty staggering. And there are regional variances as well, Brady. When you go up into the North Country, it's even more severe up there in terms of the percentage of the population that are either on public assistance or are in that elderly category. And it's something that there's some different considerations that need to be made as we deal with the issues up in the North Country versus down here.
One last question for you as we wrap up this hour, Commissioner. You've worked for Governor Lynch throughout your time as commissioner. And if I remember right, you're the first commissioner of Health and Human Services to be nominated for a second term. You've been meeting with the candidates for governor this time around. And we've heard from some of Governor Lynch's commissioners. George Bald, for example, has decided that he's going to retire before his term is up. Your four-year term runs, I believe, through 2015. Do you expect to stay on?
2016. But who's counting? It truly is an honor to do this job. It is arguably one of the most difficult jobs that I've ever done, but it's also one of the most rewarding jobs that I've ever done. So it is my intention to stay for as long as through that term. Obviously, if a new governor wants to seek a different direction to go, then I would clearly honor that. But I have a job to do. I will do that to the best of my ability, and to basically lead and support the several thousand people that I have within the Department of Health and Human Services. And there are thousands of other people that are the partners in the various agencies that Department of Health and Human Services does in order to be able to fulfill its mission.
And if you do stay on, you certainly won't be wanting for projects or issues to work on, right?
Yeah, there's never a dull moment.
Well, Commissioner, thanks as always. It's always good to have you on the show.
My pleasure, Brady. Thank you for having me.
That's Nick Tompas, Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer today is Mike Danielli. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Canoy.